Thank you very much. I want to thank the organizers for trusting me to give the first talk after the conference dinner. In case some of you are still suffering, I will make it a little more comfortable in here, turning down the lights. Maybe I'll even turn off these things out here, so you won't be distracted by the check, the prospects of a check. So it's great to be back here in Cambridge. I'm going to be talking about a paper I've done with Peter Feldhüter, a PhD student of mine at Copenhagen Business School. The title of the talk is Decomposing Swap Spreads. It sort of arises from talking to people in industry about what curve should you use to discount cash flow, what riskless rate should you be using to discount cash flows. And of course, I'm, when you take courses and stuff in math finance, you know, it's the treasury curve, right? And then you talk to bankers and stuff, and then, oh, no, no one uses the treasury curve, you know. We use the swap curve, of course. And you say, oh, yeah, sure, of course. And then you start wondering about that, you know, the swap curve, is that a good measurement of the riskless rate? And you start wondering about whether that is true. There's certainly a large spread between the swap rates and the treasury rates, and I'll talk about that in a second. And that makes you think, why is there such a spread? What is it made up of? And that's the purpose of this talk. But just to get going, let me just frame this problem very simply, naively, in fact. Just to make sure, an interest rate swap is an agreement for two parties to exchange payments. We're talking about plain vanilla interest rate swaps. So one party, the fixed receiver, receives a fixed payment every period for the duration of this contract. And the other side, and the person that receives fixed pays floating rate to the counterparty. And the floating rate in a textbook would sort of be set, would be fixed according to something like this. You take the price of the nearest maturity bond and you look at the rate of return on that, and that's going to define the floating rate payment at, or the floating rate at time t minus one, and that is being paid at time t. So that's the mechanics of the swap. And before sort of entering into this field of what's the riskless rate, you can just think of this as the treasury rate. And for a second, think of that as the riskless rate. Now, the swap contract, you set the fixed payment in such a way that the fair value of the contract is zero at initiation. And if you check out in this little simple framework what that fixed rate should be, it's straightforward to show that it has this form. If you multiply this thing over on the other side, you have the present value of the fixed payments, and you know that this is the value of the floating rate payments. It's a simple fact, you know, from term structure theory that you can express the value of those floating rate payments simply in the initial term structure. So that's the value you would get for the swap spread, the swap rate in this simple setting. And by sort of moving around a little bit, you realize that swap rate is simply a par-bond yield. So if swaps were set in the way we just did, the floating rate was set in the way we just proposed from treasuries, there would be no difference between the swap rate and a par bond rate on treasuries. Because it's exactly this rate that makes sure that this bond has par value. But in reality, the floating rate is not set according to the treasury rates. They're using a different reference, namely the LIBOR rates, which is an interbank rate, which contains some element, at least, of credit risk, and therefore is higher than the short rate on a treasury. But in fact, and that's another important part of this spread, the treasury rates are probably not riskless rates, because typically, at least certainly in U.S. markets, and we use data from U.S. markets, there are certain convenience yields to owning treasuries. The most famous convenience yield is this repo specialness that you have on, say, on newly issued treasury bonds, which means that if you own the treasury bond, You can lend it to someone who's very eager to get hold of it for short selling purposes or for other purposes. And that person is in fact so eager to get hold of this treasury that he or she is willing to lend you money at a very low rate, at a specially low rate. So therefore, there are situations in which owning a treasury bond gives you access to borrowing money at a very low rate. And that is a convenience yield that is priced into US treasuries. Of course, we don't make that convenience yield part of the cash flow when we compute internal rate of return on the bond. We just take the price and we compare it to the promised, the fixed coupons. And therefore, we get a price that is slightly higher because of the convenience yield. And therefore, we get a lower rate, perhaps, than the riskless rate. So, two reasons why we have a swap spread. That is a difference between the swap rate and the treasury rate, namely that the floating payment on the swap is linked to a floating rate, which is higher than the riskless rate. And perhaps the treasury rate to which we compare is lower than the riskless rate. So our first goal when doing this was to try and decompose those two components and understand this spread. So that's the overall goal of this paper, is to try and understand the dynamics and the term structure of the spread between swap rates and treasury rates. We're going to do a joint pricing model that incorporates both swaps, obviously, and treasuries, but also corporate bonds, because we want information about credit from the corporate bond market. We're proposing a joint pricing model that will allow us to separate out the various components. Doing that, we will discover, actually, that we need a very particular factor that I have not mentioned yet related to the swap market. I mentioned two reasons why there's a spread, but there's a third reason that I will get back to in a second, related to the swap market living its own life to a certain degree. Okay, after having done that decomposition, I can then go back and say, so which one is closer to the riskless rate, the swap rate or the treasury rate? And I'll try to indicate that towards the end. And I can also ask a question related to credit risk. I can ask whether a certain proxy for credit risk, namely the difference between LIBOR and general collateral repo rates, is a good measure of short-term AA credit risk. Why do I even ask such a question? Well, LIBOR is related to AA credit quality. General collateral repo rates are borrowing rates rates on interbank loans where you have a collateral, where the loan is collateralized, so that there is no default risk. And it says general collateral, so it's different from the repo example I gave earlier, where someone is very eager to get hold of a particular bond and therefore is willing to lend money at a low rate. When it's general collateral, the person that receives the collateral has no control over which collateral it is, just from a whole basket of possible collaterals, and therefore there's no sort of value attached to the specific collateral. Therefore, this has traditionally been a very good candidate for a riskless rate. And therefore, the spread between a AA rate and this has been a good candidate for AA credit risk. And we want to assess whether that's a good proxy. So those are the three goals: understanding the swap spreads, answering which one is closer to the riskless rate, and understanding the dynamics of the short-term AA credit risk. There's lots of related literature in this area. We're close in spirit to Colin Dufresne and Solnig, who realized and sort of implemented this fact that the underlying rate is a LIBOR rate, and used that to compare the swap rate to AA curves, AA corporate curves, and simply tried to price the swap contracts in a model that I'll be explaining a little bit about more. But we're close to that, but we incorporate a whole bunch of corporate bonds in our estimation, which they did not do, or corporate bond indices, I should say. Greg Duffy has a paper on estimation in these models that uses the Kalman filter techniques that we're also going to be using. Daryl Duffy and Singleton has this paper on estimating swap spreads, in which they fit a model to the swap spreads But their method of decomposing then is a little different. They fit a term structure model for swap spreads. But then they sort of regress the dynamics they get for this curve onto something that they think are good proxies for credit risk, like various spreads. And then by the regression coefficients, then try to identify how much of the spread arises from different sources. But we're doing a full pricing model, so we're not using regressions to identify these components. They're part of our pricing model, so that's a difference. That makes it also closer to Liu Longstaff and Mandel, but they use proxies, observable proxies, like the AA proxy I was talking about before, the LIBOR minus GC repo rate as a proxy. If that proxy doesn't work, we don't know if we're getting the right answers. So we include corporate bonds in our estimation, again, to get a better grip of credit. The other papers, Greenblatt just plainly argues that the swap rate is the riskless rate. Of course, we're going to argue that that's not the case. Reinhardt and Sack have a paper in which they do a time series estimation of a particular maturity point, 10-year, for various rates, and they identify some of the factors. But of course, they don't have any pricing model because it's just a time series model, a vector order regression for these yields, and they don't get a term structure as we do. And a lot of the interesting effects are in the composition of these swap spreads as a function of time to maturity. We use some stuff that I did on rating-based models, some closed-form solutions to handle these corporate bonds that we'll be pricing. Okay, so here's the model set up. It's a six-factor model. I know that's a lot of factors, but we actually think of it as a parsimonious model, given the fact that we're modeling treasuries, swaps, and four credit classes of corporate debt and full-term structures. So we think six factors is certainly the minimal number of factors we can apply to get a reasonable fit. Those are all independent CIR processes with, you know, the affine volatility specification here. That means that we both have the Vasi check and the CIR specification in there as possibilities. We define this thing to have mean zero for identification purposes. I'll show later that we add constants to translate away from the mean. That's a detail. But we normalize these things to have Q means of zero. And we're in the affine world, so we get closed form solutions to everything that we use. And that's important because our estimation methodology is this Kalman filter stuff, and that takes a lot of time. There's enough problems finding the maximum likelihood estimator of this thing. We don't want to be doing lots of complicated PDEs on top of that. So we stay within the affine setting to get these closed form solutions. Now I'm going to specify how we model the different markets. The government short rate is a sum of two factors, and then this constant that moves it away from zero. So here's the identification stuff I was talking about. Instead of having these have different mean reversion levels, it gets hard to identify the separate mean reversion levels of these two. So we scale them down to have zero mean reversion level and then add a common constant in there. We do that all the way. So that's our government short rate. So treasuries, US Treasury, that's going to be driving our treasury rate. Then we argue that the riskless rate, which we don't see, which is a latent variable in our model, is larger than the government rate. It has an additional factor, again, mean plus factor, which is x5. And that is sort of a bucket for accumulating, among other things, this specialness effect, but also the special love that financial institutions have for treasury securities for regulatory purposes and stuff like that. So we're not being terribly specific, but we know there are various sources that lift the treasury rate above the riskless rate. We try to capture that by this term here. So when we have that, our affine machinery just gives us prices of government bonds that are exponentially affine, and that's straightforward. So that's the treasury market and the riskless rate. Of course, we use the riskless rate for all our pricing. I mean, we discount under Q using the riskless rate. We just don't observe the riskless rate. Now, we modeled for corporate bonds simultaneously four credit curves, AAA, AA, single A, and triple B for banks and financials. We use banks and financials because we are talking about LIBOR here and therefore want to be in that territory. The price at time T of these corporate bonds, depending on rating class I, is an expected discounted value of short rate plus a loss-adjusted default intensity for the firm. To get a pricing formula here, we already have the dynamics of X. We have the dynamics of this thing. We have the functional form here, in fact. But to get this pricing formula specified completely, we need to know lambda as a function of these two variables, and we need to know the evolution of the rating class, the eta here. Then we have the full specification. So we need the functional form of lambda, and we needed dynamics of the ratings to fully specify the pricing formula for corporates. And that's what we do here. We use an intensity function as a function of rating, which is a fixed constant that we estimate a sort of baseline default-adjusted intensity, loss-adjusted default intensity, sorry, for class I, times a random scaling factor, which depends on state variables. We have transition intensity from I to J being a function of the state variable in a simple form, again, baseline intensity times this scaling factor. So the loss-adjusted default intensities and the migrations between states are like a continuous time Markov chain whose clock is being run sort of faster or slower according to this scalar process, mu of X. Mu depends on several factors, so we can get some twists and stuff from that factor. I'll show you that in a second. But that's the idea. Simplistic, but actually able to fit the various credit curves. Here's the specification of the mu factor. It depends on both the level of the riskless rate and two new factors that account for the credit term structure. So that's this sort of conditional Markov. And the purpose of doing that is to say, well, we want information about AA credit quality, but when we're looking at longer AA bonds, they are affected as well by credit quality in lower classes because they may end up in those lower classes. And therefore, we try to assemble as much information as we can from this. But we don't get too courageous. We don't think that we can capture the high yield segment in this model. So spec grade is just one black, is one place the rating can go down, and it can default, and it can migrate back from that. I know it's not Markov if you start collapsing classes like that, but we make that approximation. And we have then the baseline intensities in this for migration between the classes in this matrix. And we multiply that just to make sure. This governs the migration between different classes for the corporate bonds, but the clock is run faster or slower according to this scalar value process up there. So conditional on the sample path of that factor, we have a time non-homogeneous Markov chain. The nice thing about that specification is that you get a closed form solution for bond prices, which is a sum of affine expressions. So we have closed form solutions for.
Sorry for skipping that.
This is indeed based on a historical baseline estimated from Moody's data over a long period. So we're thinking of as an average activity in this. We don't do that. That's true for the migrations between the states. The default adjusted, I keep saying that, the loss adjusted default intensity is something we estimate. So, because that we need to crack up from away from the empirical default intensities. So we think of the migrations as running according to an empirical measure scaled up and down by this mu factor. This mu factor also scales up and down the loss adjusted default intensity. Okay, thanks, Steve. Important point. Swap rates, final thing we need. We now have, we have government rates, we have treasuries. The swap rates are set, again, according to this sort of use a short bond, the yield on a short bond. And the short rate of that short bond is the LIBOR rate, which, if LIBOR was a true AA credit quality, would be the sum of the riskless rate and the loss-adjusted default intensity for class A times this random factor. Or I mean, this is the loss-adjusted default intensity. This is what we would use for a LIBOR rate governing the swap market if it was the case that the LIBOR was exactly as a short-term corporate rate for financials and banks. But we cannot fit the swap market. This is what Pierre, Colantifine and Solnik do in their paper. They use this part actually to try and price swaps and are therefore able to analyze how this double A component affects the swap curve. We add this factor, we have to fit these markets to empirical data. And one of the highlights is going to be the interpretation of this factor, the swap factor. And that's this one down here. That's what we need our sixth variable for. And we will have an interpretation of that variable. There's an assumption we make when we price swaps. We assume that the counterparty risk is not an issue here. There's theoretical and empirical actual research to support this, that if you have two banks trading in the swap market, either they have master netting agreements or collateral agreements that make counterparty risk a very small factor. Even if they don't have that, if they're symmetric in credit quality, the effect on swap spreads from that credit from credit risk is very, very small. Daryl showed that, for example, in a paper with Minghua. So that's an assumption we make. We discount with the riskless rate, and we get close form for the swap rates. Our data are U.S. government bonds, various maturities. It's the corporate bonds that are financials we get from Bloomberg, actually. And U.S. swap rates, U.S. dollar swap rates, and three-month LIBOR. So that's our, I'll show you the sample period in a second, 96 to 2003. And this is just sort of an average plot of the curve that we get. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, except noting that the swap curve is very close, actually, to the AAA curve in this plot, but has a slightly different twist. It's certainly way above the government rate. I know there's a kink. We'll talk about that if you insist, but not now. This is a double A rate, so we're certainly between the double A.
What's the left-hand axis?
What's the scale? Yeah, I'm sorry. That's it's basis points. It is spreads. No, hold on a second. It's so isn't this 4.5%? That's a good question. I can't even see my own graph. I mean, these are yield curves, so I assume they are just percentages, but I even can't read it on my... It is 4.5, 5.0, 5.5, etc. That's what it is. So it is... Oh, I couldn't see the... There is actually a decimal point in there. Okay, so how do we estimate the model? We use a Kalman filter technique. That is, we approximate the system inverse. We want to get it in this form of the Kalman filter, which has, you know, the observation equation and the state variable, the evolution equation. What's the name, Mark? What state? No, we have the state equation here and the measurement equation here. So this shows the evolution of the state variable. That's our six factors. These are all the yields, a huge vector of yields that we observe for the various swaps, corporate bonds, treasury rates. So that's a long vector. Since we are in an affine world, if we had zero coupon bonds, the yields would be an affine function of the state variables. But we don't have zero coupon bonds, so we have coupon bonds. So we need to make an approximation, also which works well. Is to simply linearize around the forecasted value at each step, and assuming that the price is linear around that forecasted value. Remember, these can depend on T, these coefficients, so we can adjust the linear approximation at each time. So that's one approximation to get the yields on the bonds to be affine functions. Then we have the state variable, of course, is a CIR process, so it's not a Gaussian process, but we know, of course, in closed form, the mean and the variances of these of the diffusion processes that are driving. So we can make a state variable evolution that matches the first and second moment, but then we assume a Gaussian noise term, and that's the approximation there. There's lots of literature on how well this works, and it does seem to work well, but there's also a Monte Carlo study in the paper addressing various issues around these approximations, but I'm not going to talk about that. This is the Kalman filter thing that we fitted into the representation for the estimation. And then we do the Kalman filter recursion, and just to remind you if you haven't seen that, or remind you if you have seen and tell you if you haven't, what the Kalman filter recursion does is that once you fix a parameter, and then the Kalman filter routine gives you an estimate of the underlying state variable, the x's, the evolution of those, and the value of the likelihood function for that approximating system. So each run of the Kalman filter gives you an estimate of the state variable and an estimate and a value of the likelihood function, and then we have to maximize that likelihood function. And that's not an easy task, but that's what we do. I have parameter estimates that I'm not going to show you unless we have time, but these are errors that we get from fitted to observed values for the different corporate bonds, for the government bonds, for different maturities. So for example, epsilon 2 would be the error in basis points between the average 2-year yield and our estimated average 2-year yield. And that's, you know, so this would be 1.6 basis point with a standard deviation of 9 basis points. And we get okay deviations out here, standard deviations in the sort of 6, 7, 8 basis point range for these. And that's satisfactory. We get a better fit for the swap rates. The short end LIBOR is a different story. But the swap rates, we get very good fits also in average. We're very worried about the long term end of the swap curve, because that's really what drives the information that we're looking for. Okay, so once you have estimated these state variables, we find the maximum likelihood estimator, and then we ask, do these latent variables seem to represent anything that we can interpret? We are, of course, now leaning on literature that we know of from the term structure literature, that once you fit term structure models, it often turns out that these driving factors have an interpretation, and that is true in our model as well. The X1 variable that governs the treasury curve is very much related to a level. We take an affine function of a yield and find out sort of just by inspection which one is best. The 7-year yield, affine function of that, very closely follows X1. And sort of a measure of steepness that involves a difference between 7-year yields and 6-month yields, not the exact difference, but 2 times 1 minus the other one, closely traces X2. X2 closely traces something related to steepness in that curve. What's more encouraging, actually, that this wasn't surprising, because we know from treasury estimation that that's what happens. We are pretty encouraged that we can also interpret our X3 and X4 factors. That's the factors that speed up and down the migration clock and speed up and increase and decrease the loss-adjusted default intensities. Those two factors also have an interpretation. X3 is very closely related to the mean credit level of all these curves, and the X4 is related to a mean steepness measure that we sort of do by inspection. So it does seem that these credit factors also capture the shape of the term structure. What about the trade? So now I've explained that X1, X2, X3, and X4 look like they have a good interpretation. What about X5, the treasury factor, the thing that distinguishes the treasury rate from the riskless rate? How do we know that that is just vaguely reasonable to use as a proxy? We then look at another proxy that has been used, for example, in works by Longstaff and by Reinhardt and Sack, namely the spread between so-called REFCorp bonds and government bonds. REFCorp bonds are bonds that were issued in connection with the savings and loans crisis, and it is bonds that are guaranteed by the US government. So they are really thought of as riskless, and they've often been used as a proxy for riskless rate. And just to see that we're not completely off, we compare a REFCorp, a strip REFCorp term structure, without a proxy. This is our term structure. This is the RevCorp. We are actually, this is a sign that we certainly don't want to give up the interpretation that we have of our rate as a riskless rate. So the level is consistent with the RevCorp. Now the exciting factor is the sixth factor, the one that distinguishes the swap market, that separates the swap market from the corporate bond market. The factor that makes it impossible to price swaps and get a good fit just from the AA corporate rates, short AA corporate rates. And what's the interpretation of that factor? Turns out that mortgage-backed securities, the agencies, are huge participants in this US interest rate swap market. They hold huge positions of their own mortgage bonds, it turns out. And since the year 2000, they have increasingly used the swap markets to hedge their interest rate exposure from these positions. The mechanics is sort of like this. If interest rates fall, the duration of the mortgages that they own falls because people start prepaying. The agencies then enter in as fixed receivers to get a new duration match, to increase the duration, and that forces the swap rate down. So the fact that these are very big agents in this market may be what's pushing the swap market around. And here's a graph that shows an index, modified duration, mortgage-backed security index, published by Lehman Brothers. And to begin with, there's not a whole lot of correlation between our swap factor and that index. But it's well known that around the year 2000, these mortgage-backed security agencies start using the swap markets as opposed to treasury markets for hedging purposes. And let's zero in on what happens after the year 2000. This is our factor, and this is the duration index that is published by Lehman Brothers, what we think of as a very tight connection. So we are bold enough to simply call the sixth factor a mortgage-backed security hedging factor. And I don't know if we risk all sorts of lawsuits about this, but we'll see. I'll present it in the US and we'll see what happens. But it certainly, there seems to be a case that they have market impact. Here's the dynamic evolution, then, of the three components that we've identified of the swap spread. We have, this is the five-year swap spread, the difference between the five-year swap rate and the five-year treasury rate. We decompose it into the convenience yield to holding treasuries, which down here, for example, has about 15 basis points. So the units here are basis points on this axis. The total height of this colored thing is the spread, and it's decomposed into three components. The credit risk component is the yellow component. That's the additional factor that goes back to my very first slide, arising from the fact that there is a credit risk element in the short LIBOR rate. And then finally, this mortgage-backed security hedging factor that we identify, which is, graphed down here. We can also decompose the curve across maturities, and compute average yield curves. And again, we get a decomposition, which now says that in the short end, there's virtually no swap maturity premium, consistent with the fact that they probably use longer dated swaps to increase their duration. The convenience yield is high on the shorter term treasuries, or it has a higher component in the short end, and the credit risk also has an increasing component as time to maturity increases, which is also consistent with what you would expect, because over longer time periods, the AA intensity can move further away. That's the interpretation we have. So that's our decomposition of the swap spread. Note that if I sort of take out the red part, then I have the location of the riskless rate, because the convenience yield is what separates the treasury rate from the riskless rate. So in between somewhere is the riskless rate. And that allows us then to ask, what does the riskless rate look like in this model? And what we graph here is then the difference between the swap rate at 5-year maturity and the riskless rate, which is positive because the swap rate is higher than the riskless rate. And here, the difference between the government rate and the riskless rate, which is negative because the government rate is lower. And at the 5-year maturity spectrum, there's enough of a credit risk component in the swap spreads that we have a longer distance, something like 30-something basis points here, for example, between the swap curve and what we think is the riskless curve. And we have a smaller difference between the treasury and the swap, and the riskless rate at the long end. In the short end, the picture is reversed. There, the swap spread is closer, the swap rate is closer to the riskless rate than the treasury. What about this AA short-term credit spread? Can we measure the credit spread at a short maturity as the difference between a LIBOR rate and this sort of riskless rate, this collateralized lending rate? We find that we cannot do that because this proxy is way too volatile to actually serve as a proxy for credit risk. The fact that we include corporate bonds in our estimation means that we keep in check the credit risk component. Meaning that if we really try to look at the fluctuations in this rate as credit fluctuations, then that would have to affect the corporate bond spread through our model, but it doesn't. So our inclusion of corporate bonds helps keeping the credit risk component in check, sort of, and therefore filtering out a part of this which is not credit. And this following graph shows our estimated AA loss adjusted component and the LIBOR minus GC repo, which has a life of its own of very high volatility. So we don't think that's a good proxy. So in conclusion, we obtain a decomposition of the swap spread into a convenience yield, a credit factor, and a swap factor. We identify a strong component, which we think we have lots of evidence to support that is a mortgage-backed security duration hedging linked factor, which is present after 2000. The correlation on this graph I showed you is something like 0.86. And so there's very strong connection between those two, we argue. We then argue that the LIBOR minus GC repo is too volatile as a measure for short-term AA credit risk. And we conclude that the 2-year swap rate is closer to the riskless rate than the treasury rate, but at 5-year maturity, the picture is typically reversed. So that's it. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for this very interesting presentation. We have quite a bit of time left for questions and comments.
Notice you pointed out when you were trying to interpret factor X3 and X4 that you were able to interpret them in terms of the levels or changes of levels at certain maturities.
Or the levels of the credit spread curves and the steepness of those curves.
Yeah, I was wondering what techniques you'd use to locate those effects. Were those intuitive, or did you use some kind of rotational search model to?
Peter did this, and he actually did not formalize the search. So it's not like we could probably find a better match than this, but this was simply by visual inspection. But it would, of course, be more satisfactory to find sort of the best representation in terms of these functions, but we haven't done that. So it's pure visual inspection.
I think there are some techniques where you can kind of rotate in the vector space and search more formally for interpretation.
I'd be interested in learning about that. Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions?
In your mortgage back grant,
yes?
You say about the factor. Do you notice that at the end of your time,
you
think the other side?
Yeah, it became negative, and I can't remember the story, but it's we are in a refinancing wave that is probably there is a refinancing wave,
but
and I think it's fading out. And that
it's the same
it?
As the finding the factors. How did you bump into mortgage-backed security?
because we have, there are several people who, Reinhardt and Sack at one place, or is it, or maybe it's, they mentioned that, that the swap agencies use the swap curves to hedge, and therefore they say that the swap market is different from the treasury market from that reason, because they say, I think it may be actually also, there's Woolrich from the BIS, who has a paper or a report where he says that many of these market makers in the swap market are simply, you know, not completely able to absorb that immense demand from the mortgage agencies, and that the demand from the mortgage agencies actually has a price impact.
We are very interested in that particular factor because we have a lot of difficulty calibrating the catch and the swaptions.
Okay. From treasury curves or just you're looking at swap curves in themselves or
swaptions.
Yeah, but are you starting off with the swap curve and then pricing swaptions off that or?
Typically you come from the caps and floors and then you go back to the swaptions. Perhaps you can start with it.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see how you can affect
us. I mean, we haven't. We just estimate our factor, right, from the pricing model. It's the factor that makes our Kalman filter, that gives us the maximum likelihood estimator, you know, the joint fit of the curves.
So what is your story just now about it turning negative? To
well, is there some experts, there are probably someone who knows this better than I do. There is a refinancing wave in the early 2000s, I think, which is responsible for the for the positiveness of this, and then I think maybe that fades out in because I mean, people have refinanced using the low interest rate environment because it's been a low interest rate environment for such a long time, and now the tendency is reversing. I think that's the story, but I have a slight hedge on that story. But I think that is the explanation.
Just a comment. The Kalman filtering technique you, as you said, quite widely used in this field, but it is actually a rather complex case of the EM algorithm of Arthur Dempster of Harvard. That's really what the original EM algorithm was filling in missing observations.
The Kalman can do the same thing, of course. Yeah. It has some problems. We're sort of. I mean, our comfort is that we're in good company with these problems. You know, it's something that all the estimations of Greg Duffy and all this, we do find serious autocorrelation in the residuals after estimating the model. We correct for that when we do standard deviations, but it's a problem.
But are you using? I mean, this was part of the question earlier. You're not using formal techniques to extract your factors. Or are you?
The factors are just independent CIR processes, and then we postulate a form, you know, a two-factor form for the riskless rate and so forth, and then the Kalman filter spits out the realization of the fact of the state variables. So that's it. But it's kind of encouraging that the latent factors are so interpretable. That's something I find that makes me trust the model more than I would sort of otherwise do. That's why we think it's important also that this treasury factor looks like this Ref Corp government spread. I mean, it's certainly same order of magnitude. That sort of makes it a little more credible that it's in the right ballpark.
In the Kalman filter, you have where do the noise covariances come from? When you specify
it's IL, oh, yeah. The I mean, you specify. Oh yeah, how do okay? So we make the state equation fit the conditional moments.
Yeah.
Then you're asking how do we estimate the errors? We do assume a diagonal structure for these error terms. And I think we just estimated.
That's probably your problem with.
That could be a source of autocorrelation.
We've been doing it, assuming a full covariance matrix.
For the HT and the. and the Q2.
It's not exactly the same problem, but it's the same.
Well, the one of them we can calculate. I mean, one of them is part of our dynamics from the affine structure. Not the QT. No, these are estimated. The QTs actually we can derive, right? But the HTs we need to just estimate. But it does have some problems. We don't have the perfect model specification, but I'm still pretty impressed with what it actually, how well it does. It's smoothing this this filter. It's really quite powerful. And of course, it's also a strength of this that we estimate the whole thing jointly. We don't do treasuries first and then add layers. We actually estimate the whole system. That is, Peter estimates the whole system jointly by some very, very strong optimization searches. And we've done a lot of profile likelihoods to see that these parameter estimates look sensible. And to the best of our knowledge, they are really sensible estimates.
Okay, so I suggest that we postpone further questions to the coffee break and thank David again.
Okay.